with that, you are all here tonight with us for the CORE volunteer training. Thank you so much for coming out to learn a little bit more about CCL and what we do, and to learn specifically today about understanding our Congress and the basics of the legislative process. And on this call tonight to help us learn about that, I'm joining you from San Diego, California as your membership coordinator. My name is Sarah Wanis. And we also have Taylor Krause. Taylor is on our DC team, and she helps us get everything organized out there. She first started with Citizens Climate Lobby as an intern with our executive director, Mark Reynolds, here in San Diego, and then became his assistant. And then she now she works in DC as the coordinator for national partnerships. So she's gonna help us shed some light on the processes in Congress and Congress and the legislative process. So we have a couple of learning goals for this lesson. After tonight's lesson, we want to make sure that you are aware of what a typical day for a member of Congress looks like and highlight some of the opportunities and challenges that elected officials face. We want to make sure that you understand the makeup of Congress and how to best engage with professional staff in the legislative process. And we want to prepare you to use CCL's tools to be more engaged with your member of Congress. So that's kind of what we're going to go over today, and specifically on the agenda. We'll go over the membership and terminology of Congress, what the committees and chambers are, the legislative process, what life's like for a member of Congress, and where you can find more resources through CCL about all of this. And with that, I'll turn it over to Taylor.
Great. Thanks so much, Sarah. I really appreciate everybody being here tonight, wanting to learn a little bit more about your legislative process. Just to preface again, you're here to learn, and so there are no stupid questions. I definitely did not know anything really about how Congress is all organized until I started working with CCL. So thank you for taking the time to educate yourself. So tonight we're going to start with just the term of Congress member. So Congress member or Congressman or Congresswoman normally refers to the member of the House of Representatives, while for the senators, we just call them senators. We use the term MOC often in CCL, which is an acronym for Member of Congress. So you'll probably hear these pretty often if you come out to DC in June. Each chamber of Congress has an elected leader. In the House chamber, this person is known as the Speaker of the House, which right now you've probably heard of the name is Nancy Pelosi. The Senate Majority Leader is Mitch McConnell right now. And the Majority Leader customarily serves as the chief representative of their party in the Senate. So now let's move on to where these MOCs work, which is in their committees and chambers. The U.S. Congress has two chambers, the Senate and the House. Each state only has two senators, which serve six-year terms. While the House, there is one representative from each district. How many districts are within a state varies, but there are 435 districts total in the United States. And these representatives of the House, they serve two-year terms as opposed to senators who serve a longer term. The number of representatives for a state depends on how many districts. Like I said, those differ. So these are determined by population. So the more people you have in your state, the more districts that you have and are separated into. So you can imagine there's a lot more representatives and districts coming from California or other densely populated states than you would imagine for a state like Rhode Island. So some quick trivia. Does anybody know how many states only have one representative? Wow, you guys are so smart. It's actually seven states only with one representative. So that's Alaska, Delaware, Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Vermont, and Wyoming. Therefore, between the Senate and the House, there are 535 members of Congress, 100 coming from the Senate and 435 coming from the House of Representatives. Moving on, Congress divides its tasks by legislative tasks, oversight tasks, and administrative tasks, approximately 200 committees and subcommittees. So your member of Congress will probably belong to one of these committees. And in committees, this is pretty much where the work is done. There are different kinds of committees. So there are a standing, there's a select, and there is a joint committee. So the standing committees are permanent panels. They have actual legislative jurisdiction. Standing committees consider bills and issues and recommend measures for consideration for their respective chambers. So whether they're in the House or whether they're in the Senate, that can then be brought to the full chamber itself at some point. So select committees are temporary ones. You've probably heard of a lot of these recently. So the Select Committee on Climate Change, maybe particularly, and they do other things like conduct investigations or conduct specific studies. And while the last is joint committees, they are also permanent, but they focus more on the housekeeping tasks rather than considering legislative measures. So traditionally, what you think of when you hear of a congressional committee is the standing committee that I primarily mentioned, which is the one that's permanent and has legislative jurisdiction. It's not uncommon for a committee in the House or the Senate with the same jurisdiction to go by different names. So for example, in the House committee, we have Ways and Means, which deal with things like taxes. And in the Senate, they have an equivalent committee just known as the Senate Finance Committee. These committees, which are separated into different topics, is where bills and resolutions move forward for consideration. So if a piece of legislation is introduced and it touches a specific committee, it goes to that committee before it can then be considered by the full chamber. So the entire House or the entire Senate. And that's what is meant if you've ever heard the phrase a bill being in committee. And if you're coming in June, this is something that a lot of staffers are going to be talking about to you and asking you which committees are bill touches. So we also have biographies for each member of Congress that you will receive to highlight their current committee assignments. And this is a valuable tool to understand the bills that fall within their jurisdiction and different topics that they deal with, and maybe be more in the paradigm of the member of Congress you're speaking with or the staffer that you're speaking with if you're coming to June or in future lobby meetings. And now taking a step back from committees, we can take a look at some of the major differences between the House and the Senate, because I've talked about some similarities, but they are two different chambers and serve two different purposes. So in the Senate, the majority still holds a significant advantage when it comes to scheduling which bills come to the floor. That any single senator can stop legislation from moving forward on his or her own. While debate is limited in the House, debate in the Senate does not end until 60 senators vote for, it's called a cloture motion that moves the bill forward for consideration. If the majority does not currently bring to the table 60 votes on its own, it must work with the majority to set the rules for debate on important legislation. Often this means that majority pieces of legislation can be debated for 1 or 2 weeks on the Senate floor. And in the House, the majority party rules. So the House conducts most of its important business by passing rules that determine the framework under which a bill will be debated. Since these rules can only require a simple majority, the party with the most votes controls the debate. So in most cases, rules limit debate so the major bills can be passed during one day's legislative business. So in the Senate, if your House, I mean, if you're majority leader, you can easily bypass committees, meaning that if Mitch McConnell wants to bring a bill to the floor, he can bring a bill to the floor whenever he wants. He can more easily bypass the committees that they would otherwise go through, which is definitely different to the House of Representatives, where the committees consider the bills more in their small space. The Senate, because it's 100 versus 435, they and considered a higher level, they have a more open debate about different items that are brought to the floor, whereas in the House of Representatives, the debate is a lot more limited, and this is due for mainly the fact that there are 435 members, and they have to regulate it somehow in order to get things moving along. And moving on into more of the legislative, and again, in the Senate, there are fewer committees than in the House of Representatives. And if you want more information on everything that we're covering, we'd also be happy to go more into detail about specific questions that you have. We're also going to be providing you with a lot of resources because we know that we're throwing a lot of information at you tonight to go through and have for your reference so you feel nice and confident before you come in June. So moving on to the legislative process, we are going to talk about how a bill becomes law. So for Energy Innovation Act, what that shepherding process is going to look like. So we have done the first big step, which is having a bill introduced into the House of Representatives. So bills can be introduced in either the House or the Senate. If you've been with CCL, you would know that in this last Congress, the 115th Congress, we introduced the Energy Innovation Act in both the House and the Senate. So they're bicamerally introduced. And this Congress, we have had a House bill introduced, and we are still working on the Senate reintroduction. So there are instances when different bills of the same, different versions of a bill can be begin in both chambers concurrently. So let's say in the House, for example, there was a difference in the regulatory component of the bill that was introduced, but in that differed from the Senate version that we had, but in fundamentally, they were pretty much the same versions of each other. And so bills can only be introduced by members of Congress. And this is why this has been a long process for CCL, because we've been manifesting those relationships with members of Congress for a long time through our volunteers and constituents, that a member of Congress was able to bring forth our bill in the last Congress and then again in this Congress. So many bills are introduced by a congressional co-sponsor. Once introduced, new bills are numbered. So right now, the number for the Energy Innovation Act is House Resolution, or HR as they're usually referred to, 763. And then they are sent off to their appropriate committees. And we talked a little bit about committees. So committee action bills come under the most intense scrutiny while in committee. And this is unfortunately where a lot of bills die. And so you'll probably hear the term a bill dying in committee. So the bill is considered either by the full committee or the subcommittee. After hearings and a study to mark up the bill, so all these different committees can go under their own process to mark up what they have issues with and what different amendments or what they'd like to see. And then the full committee votes on a recommendation to the full House or the full Senate. So everybody who's that committee or that topic is that isn't under their jurisdiction, they have an educated resource and people who have looked, their colleagues that have looked at it. The committee may also order a clean bill with a new number to be reintroduced. That's kind of peripheral. And then there the floor action. So the next process, let's say that it gets through committee and they want to vote on it, it gets brought to the floor. So, and this is when it appears in front of the entire House or Senate, and the two chambers, as I mentioned before, they have different procedures for floor debate. So the House Rules Committee regulates debate for each bill, issuing the rule for the bill. Members can speak on a bill for a set period of time as specified in the rule. To speed debate on some bills, the House meets as the Committee of the Whole, which has different rules for floor debate. So the Committee of the Whole can amend a bill but cannot pass it. Whereas in the Senate, debate is unlimited. Senators may speak at any length of any topic, and any senator can stop debate with what's known as a filibuster, which I'm sure some of you have heard of before. Debate can be closed by unanimous consent or by invoking, as I mentioned before, a cloture, which requires a 3/5 majority. So in the Senate, being a body of 100 members, that's about 60 votes of the entire Senate. So for the second chamber, once one chamber has voted to pass on a bill, the other chamber may pass it with the language intact, refer to it to their committee for more alterations, reject the bill in its entirety, informing the other chamber of its actions, or ignore the bill while continuing to work on its own version of the legislation. So as you probably have heard for previous previous initiatives or previous legislation, if one bill is introduced in the House and the majority is of Democrats, whereas right now where we have a Senate-led majority in right now, you can see when they pass over, when they're passed amongst each other, how there are some political ramifications of not being under one party and how a lot of legislation just sometimes doesn't make it through. There is a conference when the two chambers passing different versions of legislation, the bill goes to conference. So conferees for the House and the Senate committees that worked on the bill meet together to work out a compromise. Conferees are not allowed to write new legislation. They must work within the boundaries of differences in the House and the Senate bills. When the conferees have reached an agreement, they submit a report of the recommendation to each chamber for approval. And then comes in the president. So the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate both sign the majority bill and they send it off to the president. And then there are four options from there. So if the president signs and dates the bill, we're done, it becomes law. If Congress is in session and the president does not sign the bill within 10 days, the bill becomes law without the need for his or her signature. The president may veto the entire bill. So the bill goes back to Congress for a second vote, in which it must get a 2/3 majority vote in each chamber in order to become law. If Congress adjourns within the 10 days of giving the bill to the president and he or she does not sign it, the bill will die. And this is what's called a pocket veto, because the president just puts the bill in their pocket and doesn't do anything about it. And if you're looking for more in depth, I did just throw a ton of information at you. And I personally have had to go through this multiple times. There is a further resources that we recommend in a wonderful guide done by Politico, which is a really well-known political resource. And it has great simplified infographics to the legislative process in both the House and the Senate. And we'll post that in the chat. You can also brush up on shamelessly through Schoolhouse Rock. I admit that I have looked at Schoolhouse Rock a couple of times since even starting to work for CCL, and it really does a great job of bringing you the fundamentals of how the legislative process works. And our legislative process in the United States was specifically designed to be a meticulous and long, slow process, which now can seem very frustrating to the average citizen. And so understanding it is definitely something that we appreciate you taking the time tonight to do. So moving on to congressional offices themselves, these are actual jobs of real people. And as CCLers, we like to bring back to that idea every time we train volunteers on how to interact with their congressional members and their staff. So each member of Congress has at least two different offices, one in the state or district and a legislative office, which is in here in DC, on Capitol Hill, or as we call it, just the Hill here. If the member of Congress represents a large state or district, they may have more than one local office. Not monolithic, each has their own budget. So in the House, there is $1.4 million a year, whereas the Senate, it really just varies depending on your state. And most of that goes to the to the staff, where the House offices, they have a limited staff that they can have, which is 18 full-time staff. And that might sound like a lot, but you're also organizing that into your in-district office of everybody that maintains administrative tasks and your DC office here that does your legislative staff. And four part-time staff. And then the Senate, though, they do not have any limits, and it just depends on what their budget is, and it varies and depending on how they want to allocate that. So it's just like a business. They have to hire staff. They have to purchase equipment like computers. They have to have furniture for their offices. They have to provide services to their customers, which are their constituents and you guys. Next, we're going to go over the different roles, but we do recommend, I'll also throw this in the chat. It is a citizen's handbook to influencing elected officials. And we're going to go over the roles of legislative staff. And these are really important because in your lobby meetings, you will be meeting with different people who have different roles in that office. And it's always good to have context in terms of what their job is and what they're going to do with the meeting content and what they probably already know and what different topics that they work on. And so we'll start off with the top, which is the chief of staff, which I'm sure is a role that you've probably heard in movies or different TV shows. And this is the head honcho of the congressional office. This is the person that is usually closest to the advisor to the closestly advises the legislator, and perhaps is a very longtime personal friend, or they worked diligently on the campaign with them, but this is their trusted person. And they really run the operation much like a chief of operations officer would in a business. Next is the legislative director, or as we call them, the LD. This is the senior policy advisor to the office. This is the person that likely has been with the office for more than a couple of years. And they've been promoted from a legislative assistant, which I'll go over after this. And they oversee a majority of the policy decisions. She or he is likely the one that oversees and edits all of the newsletters, emails drafted by more junior staffers, and has jurisdiction over the issues most important to the legislator or the most prominent issues as determined by the committee assignment that I talked about earlier about the legislator. Next is the legislative assistant. So this is probably the person that you're going to be meeting with in DC. A legislative assistant, also known as an LA, is the primary office expert on a particular issue. So she or he drafts statements and speeches or writes memos on certain legislation for the member of Congress. So as you can imagine, there's just tons of different topics that are going on. And so each legislative assistant, there are usually a couple in the office, they're responsible for a portfolio of a few issues. But in the House, LAs can honestly have up to about 15 different issues. So they can be talking to you about healthcare and then put on their different portfolio hat and be talking to you about climate change. So it's always important to keep in mind the fact that they are spinning a lot of plates. And the jurisdiction of the Senate LAs range from probably 1 to 10 issues. This just depends on the size of the office. House LAs, they really tend to be much younger. You'll see that if you come to DC, while the Senate, they tend to be a little bit older and have actual graduate degrees. Next is the legislative staff, which are both, they can be research assistants and policy advisors to the members of Congress. Just depends what office you're meeting with. They research the facts of an issue, collect positions of interest from their party or other collaborative organizations. They analyze the implications to constituents and synthesize the information for legislators. So they really are the diligent little researchers in the office. And LAs also can interject recommendations on policy decisions on almost all issues in their portfolio and also do things like research memos. And they really do become policy experts by the time that they're done with what their portfolio holds. No matter how limited their experience with the issue, they really do influence legislators, and they depend on their team to shepherd their decisions. And so when you have meetings, it is also of great virtue to be meeting with a staffer, because they are the one that is probably influencing the member of Congress on what their decisions will be. We also have the legislative correspondent. This is a staffer called an LC, and is primarily responsible for managing and drafting responses to mail. So they serve more of an administrative function. They typically are very young, under 25, and have less than 2 years of experience on the Hill. They really toil at a thankless job, sorting through thousands of emails, faxes, postcards, letters, with all the hope that they'll eventually be promoted to an LA after another LA finds another job. So if you meet with a legislative correspondent, it probably means that you, the LA at the time with the jurisdiction of what you'll be covering, so probably environmental issues, just had a scheduling conflict and could not meet with you that day. Next is a staff assistant. So this staffer primarily handles phone calls to the office and greets visitors. Wise legislators hire someone from the district or the state for this job in their Washington office, so that callers feel more of an instant connection. If you've called into an office, you probably have dealt with a staff assistant, and they'll ask you, "Oh, where are you from?" just to check if you're actually from their district and maybe get to chatting. And last, but certainly not least, is a scheduler. So this staffer may also share the title of office manager and is responsible for the legislator's schedule. Some lawmakers often have two schedulers, one in DC and another one in district, in the state district. The scheduler is the ultimate gatekeeper. And they really may be the person that decides whether or not you or your group gets to meet up with the legislator. So always be nice to your scheduler. And really try not to be disappointed again if you don't get to meet with your member of Congress or a specific policy aide. Not meeting with the pertinent staffer is not necessarily a slight. These really are busy people. And if it happens again and again, then it probably is a slight, and you might have to recalibrate the way that you're communicating with that office and see what's going on. So that was a little bit of a taste of what the different roles are. But now let's look at Congress as a whole and seeing what it's like working in Congress. So typically what it's like to work as a staffer on Capitol Hill, they work really long hours at an extremely fast pace and in very cramped conditions. If it's going to be your first time in DC, and you go into a member of Congress's office, you'll see this firsthand, how sometimes itsy bitsy in lots of people in one tiny space there are. And this is because the number of staff that a House member is allotted by law has not changed since the 70s. Despite the fact that the workload and the expectation has grown exponentially, each office has received anywhere from a 200% to 1,000% increase in constituent mail in the past decade alone, and then also including the invention of email. So they have 6,000 to 25,000 emails in a week. Nevertheless, when surveyed, 87% of members of Congress say that email has made it easier to become more involved. And 3 in 1 said it's made representatives and senators a lot more accountable to listening to their constituents. But only 41% say it's increased constituents' understanding of DC. And constituents really do play a vital role. And so these folks, again, you'll see is they're all pretty young because they're working in such a fast-paced environment that requires little experience, and it's something that you take on the job. So the average legislative assistant that you'll meet is about 27 years old. So imagine what it's like when we have hundreds of our CCLers calling or emailing one office, and they have just a finite amount of staff to manage it. You'll just have to take into account that these people are human too, and that this is their day to day, and they're dealing with a ton of different information coming at them. And so next, according to a group that conducts congressional studies that we trust, which is known as the Congressional Management Foundation, have a few insights into what the life is like for a member of Congress. So members of Congress work about 70 hours a week while in session. And then for out of session, they work about 59 hours a week. So it's still a really pretty busy day. They have about 13 meetings a day, and they spend about 78% more than 40 weekends in their actual district a year. So they're doing a lot of traveling, going back and forth from DC to where they're from. 35% of their total time spent as members of Congress is on legislation, meeting with colleagues, being in committees, doing other political actions within the House for legislative means. And the rest of the time, 32% of the time is with home constituent services. And then 17 to 18% of the time is on political campaigns and getting reelected. So again, the number of staff for House was set to 18 full-time staff. This was set into law in 1974. The average House is about 9 in DC and then 7 staff in district. The Senate has 22 in DC usually and about 13 in district, but again, that varies. And so that was a nice quick overview of what it's like to be in a congressional office and what staff that they're dealing with. And I will hand over the rest to Sarah.
Yes, so just really quickly, we wanted to talk a little bit more about the Congressional Management Foundation, which is where Taylor got that information on those last two slides. The Congressional Management Foundation is a really great organization that collects information about how citizens and how citizens interact with Congress and how they can do it most effectively. And we do have some resources from them on community. So if you go to community under resources, you'll find the Congressional Management Foundation. And their mission is to it says that citizens' trust in an effective and responsive Congress is essential to democracy. The Congressional Management Foundation advances this goal by working directly with members of Congress and staff to enhance their operations and interactions with constituents. CMF works directly with citizen groups to educate them on how Congress works, give constituents a stronger voice in policy outcomes. The results are that Congress is more accountable, transparent, and effective, and informed, and an informed citizenry with greater trust in democratic institutions. And just to highlight a couple of the main things that CMF has found doing all of the great work that they do. Firstly, direct constituent interactions have more influence over lawmakers than other advocacy strategies. And that's great because that's a lot of what we do here at CCL. In three surveys of congressional staff over a 10-year span, they found that 99% in 2004, 97% in 2010, and 94% in 2015 said that in-person visits from constituents would have some or a lot of influence on an undecided lawmaker. So all of you who said you're going to DC, or any of you who have gone to in-district lobby meetings or supported your group in putting those on, you're really making a big difference there. They also found that Congress places a high value on groups and citizens who have built relationships with the legislators and staff. So when asked what advocacy groups should do more of to build relationships with the office, 79% of staff surveyed said, meet or get to know the legislative assistant with jurisdiction over your issue area. And 62% said, meet or get to know your state or district director. So those are more things that we're doing here at CCL that help you get the ear of your member of Congress more. They also found that citizen advocates are more influential and contribute to better public policy when they provide personalized and local information to Congress. So 9 out of 10, or 91% of congressional staffers surveyed said that it would be helpful to have information about the impact of a bill or issue on the district or state. However, only 9% report that they actually receive that information frequently. Similarly, 79% said that a personal story from a constituent related to the bill or issue would be helpful, but only 18% report that they receive it frequently. So doing things like delivering the household impact study or telling your personal climate stories are really effective in meetings, and that's why we ask you to do that. And lastly, on this note, they found that citizens have a significant potential to enhance their advocacy skills and influence Congress. So after concluding 40 hours of CMF and Feeding America advanced advocacy training conducted over 4 months, some citizen advocates they were working with from local food banks and members of Congress, it said, whereas 12% of congressional staff report that the typical constituent they meet with is very prepared, 97% of the people who went through those trainings were very prepared. So doing things like attending this training right now are making you even more prepared for when you go to that meeting with your member of Congress. And with that, just a final thank you. You can find contact information here. So Brett, who's normally on this call, you can email him at brett@citizensclimate.org. And you can contact Taylor, who had all these wonderful answers and information for you, at taylor@citizensclimate.org. All right. Thank you all so much.
Hope to see you all in June. Come say hi if you do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.